Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Sun's coming out, looking nice out there. You know, it was kind of a lugubrious day, but it's a lot nicer now. And I have a secret for you. I want to tell you how to stay young. Anyone interested in that around here? Yeah, a lot of us. I see that hand. This is very simple, but I think it really is critical, and that is to choose a life of wonder. That is, to look at everything around you accurately, which is to look at everything with a wondrous eye. Wow. I called it the big wow. Wonder. Let me tell you something wonder-filled about our passages this morning. What you have is this fabulous and wonderful juxtaposition of the huge, the lofty, the things that are going to take centuries to unfold, mixed right in with the everyday mundane realities of life, and yet even those mundane realities fit to have a little part to play in the big picture. Does not knock you out the way it does me? I hope it does. I'll give you an example. In our passage, we have this very cryptic example of this cryptic enactment, if you will, where God promises to Abraham, listen, one day your descendants are going to be so many and you're going to have all this land and things are going to go great with you. And as Dave pointed out, we're in Genesis 12, Abram just kind of takes off and doesn't require much information. Here, Abram begins to interact relationally with God and says, how am I going to know these things going to happen? Because this is really way out stuff. The revised nickel version here, you get that. Okay. So God says, well, I'm going to do something very special. And he causes Abraham to fall into a deep sleep. Prior to that, he has Abraham take some animals and slaughter them and put them on two sides of a path. Then he causes the deep sleep. And in this vision that he receives in that sleep state, a torch, a burning torch, processes down the path between the two sides where the slaughtered animals are. And maybe you've wondered, what is that all about? Well, I want to tell you what it's all about. In the second millennium before Yeshua, you had in the Middle East ways of making covenants or contracts. And one of them went like this. Two people made a contract about something important. They would slaughter animals and put them on either side, and both parties, in the presence of witnesses, would walk down the path between the parts. And the message was this: if I don't fulfill my side of the bargain, if I don't fulfill the terms of the contract, may what happened to these animals happen to me. You get that? That's the idea. Now think about this. Incredibly lofty, fabulous picture. God is presented as the one passing through the parts, so as to say to Abraham, listen, you can count on me. I am going to keep up what I promised when I said to you that you're going to inherit this land and have all this great blessing. Now that's the lofty part. And don't you think that's wonderful? I think it's great. But then right after that, we have this domestic account where Sarah, and back then there was polygamy, and you had these, you know, different, you had the guy and you had his wife who had the, would get the inheritance and or multiple wives, and then there was the pilegesh, the concubine. You had these different relationships. And Sarah says to her husband, listen, I know you want kids, I want kids too. All right, I wasn't able to have kids. You do this. So he takes, you know, the story, he takes the other. And she gets mad because the concubine is throwing it in her face, you know, saying, boy, it's really great to be pregnant. I feel, you can feel the baby. And And it was driving Sarah nuts because it was making her jealous. So what do we have? We have this grand universal picture juxtaposed against the mundane elements of life, and life presents itself, and yet it's all part of the picture. Now, all of that by way of introduction, because what I'd like to do today is I'd like to look at a seemingly small part of the picture and how it may fit a very much larger picture. Life with people together in a community and how it may fit. And the reason I'm sharing this with you is that our membership meeting is coming up in a couple of weeks on November the 10th, and all of you who are members, you need to commit yourself to be there. Don't make excuses. It's really, really, really important for reasons I'll explain as we go along. But I want you to get a sense of something. I want you to get a sense of what this community is all about. We have new people here. We have people who may have not have heard these things. And for all of us, it's good to be reminded of how our little, teeny, mundane, small driving to services on a rainy day can fit into this much larger picture. How our part in the symphony is part of something much larger. So again, we have this wonderful picture, as I explained. Now, where does our story begin? It begins in a Boston hotel room. It begins with a woman named Shirley Weinraub. She would not mind my mentioning her name at all here. Shirley was a real estate lady. She lived in Boston, Jewish woman, and she had a boyfriend, and they were in a hotel room. I don't recall the detail, whether they stoned, whether they high from booze. I don't know. I don't know any of that. But this comes from her. She told me this, and I believe she's a trustworthy person. He was trying to kill her. And she's on the bed facing up, and his hand is on her throat. And in Boston hotels back in those days, many hotels, because it's a predominantly Roman Catholic city, there would be crucifixes on the walls of the hotels. Obviously not right now, but this we're talking 40 years ago or so. And so she feels like she's dying, and she calls out to the guy on the wall, "Save me, help me." The next thing she knows, she is awake, she comes to, the guy's gone, and she just knows that guy helped her. I think she knew it was Yeshua. I think that she knew that much. And she didn't know what to do with all this, so she figured, well, let me go into a church. And she went into, and again, back then in particular, most of the churches were Roman Catholic, so she goes into this church, and at the front of the church, it's empty, there's no service going on, she sees a guy, and he's crying in the front. So she goes up to him and asks, "Why are you crying?" And he says, "Well, I'm Jewish, and I believe in the Messiah." I don't know his exact words. "I believe in the Messiah, and my people are just, you know, not taking me seriously and rejecting all this and not interested in this." She goes, "I'm Jewish too." Wow. They become friends. His name was Sam. And they become friends and start Ruach Israel in 1978. That's when they began with just a little meeting. The incorporation occurred in 1979. Next year is our 40th birthday. We got to celebrate, right? Right. So they meet and they start in little hotel rooms. Then a couple other people come and they decided that they, that is Shirley and her husband, wanted to go to Florida to start a bagel business with Harold and Helen. And they want to team up and start a bagel business. So there's no one to lead this little group. And I had learned a few months prior to that from Dan Juster, who's a friend, that there was a little group in Boston who needed a leader. And Sue said, "Why don't you call him?" And I said, "I don't want to call him." And she said, "Why don't you call him?" I said, "I don't want to call him." Why? Because I had met a couple of those people a few years earlier, and let me say, I wasn't impressed. She said, "Why don't you call him?" I don't want to call him. She said, "Why don't you call him?" I said, "Okay, I'll call him." Yeah. And so on a Thursday in June of 1981, I call up and talk to Shirley, and I talk to another guy, this guy, Harold, terrific guy. And we worked it out that the only time that I could come to speak to the group was the next day, Friday. So I got an airline flight late that night and hopped on a plane and came to Boston and spoke to Ruach Israel and it was a little group meeting in the Travel Lodge. You ever hear of the Travel Lodge? It was a hotel on, it was 1200 Beacon Street. Let's just say it didn't have the best reputation. Do I need to say any more? Yeah, I don't think I do on Shabbat morning. So it didn't have the best reputation, and they invited me to speak, and I spoke. And afterwards, you know, we weren't as Shabbat observant as we are now, so we went out for Chinese food, which I wouldn't do now, but back then we did. And they invited me to become the leader that night. And I called Susie, and I said, "Sue, I think this is from God." And she said, "Yeah, okay, good." So we decided to come. So we came, and we met in the Travel Lodge, but we couldn't stay there long. First of all, there were two big pillars right in the center of the room, which blocked everyone's view, and the walls were carpeted. So the little bit of music that we did have, it felt like it fell on the floor, you know, right outside the instrument. But I knew we had to leave when one Friday night, see, there was a bar right next to our meeting room with a thin wall, and the rock band would kick in around 8 o'clock on Friday night, every Friday night. Well, I was trying to do Hazikaron, holding the Kiddush cup, and they were playing Moon Dance by Van Morrison. Ba ba do ba do ba, and I'm going, da ba, da ba, da ba. And I knew at that point we needed to move, and we did. We moved to Newton, to what had been the Howard Johnson's back then. And then, to make a long story short, because I want to get into a lot of other things, then we were there for a couple years until some anti-Semitic staff members or whatever were making swastikas, you know, carving them in our amplifier. We had to put all the equipment away. All we owned was, you know, one little cart that we put the amplifiers on, and we knew we had to leave. So fast forward a little bit, and I met a pastor who was the leader of a small church, and they needed a facility, and we needed a facility, and so we started dreaming about having a joint facility together. We got this piece of land, 1.78 acres in Needham. I remember the night we got it, the phone was shaking, like, okay, now we got land, what do we do? And we started raising funds, and the Mennonite community in Pennsylvania got wind of this amazing thing where a Messianic Jewish synagogue and a Mennonite church were going to build together. And something resonated inside of these Mennonite, mostly elderly Mennonite people. And when you get them excited about something, there's no stopping them. They quilted quilts for us. They came up with a tractor trailer, refrigerated tractor trailer of shoe fly pies and strawberry shortcake and things. We had these big auctions at the Natick High School where thousands of people came. No joke. We had billboards all over the city, big billboards. And they came and we raised all kinds of money. And then we had this horrible thing happen. The town of Needham wouldn't allow us to build, and it was very unfair. And we got into what ended up a four-year legal battle with the town. And I remember there was one kind-hearted policeman who said to us, "You're never going to win. They're going to fight you until you have no money, and they're going to wear you down emotionally. You will never build your building in Needham." Somebody else said, "You know, the town has never lost a zoning case since 1711 when the town was formed, you know." So, but we felt that this was a battle which wasn't about us only. It was a battle about what was right and wrong. And if they could keep us out, and we had elements in the Jewish community. This is really odd. Let me just say parenthetically. We had one of the synagogues sending their kids around with petitions, "Don't let that group into town." But we also had anti-Semitic neighbors across the street who shot out our windows and once started a fire on the property. I mean, it was something. And we're told, "You'll never build." Well, I remember the day. 4 years later, we went to court, finally got a court date. And at that time, there was a shortage of judges to hear civil cases. There were enough criminal case judges, but not enough civil. And they brought out of retirement an elderly, very tall gentleman named Judge Hurd, H-E-R-D. He had been a real estate lawyer, and he was a judge, but he had retired. And I remember walking into the Dedham court, and what do I see? But the town attorney backslapping the judge. I don't know what they were talking about. Maybe a fishing trip, who knows what. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, or oy vey more accurately. And I didn't know what to think until 5 minutes into the trial, the judge says, and I will quote him with his type of accent, "I have a feeling there's going to be a church building in Needham." 5 minutes in, and he said it three times during the haze. "I have a feeling there's going to be," and it was so wonderful because he knew that it was a not in my backyard kind of case, that there was no legitimate case against us at all, and that we had every right to be there. So we built the building, and it was a wonderful experience, to say the least. Oh, I should tell you, when we won the court case, there were two town papers, and I don't recall which one. We have the article upstairs, but I didn't check it out. One of the two town papers had a headline: "Amazing case, higher power rules in congregation's favor." We like that one, you know. We like that. We thought, and it was true. What are we talking about? We're talking about the lofty things that Abraham experienced with God, and then seemingly mundane things, but things that have a real meaning in the overall scheme of things. Maybe small, but still meaningful. That's really the context and what I'm trying to get out. So we build. But I want to talk with you about the things that we thought about and we learned, the underpinnings of our philosophy, our outlook, that have shaped us from that day to this. Things that get me very excited, and I know get many of you excited as well. But I want to talk about what we're trying to do, and not just us. We're talking about the Messianic Jewish movement generally. And that is, what we're trying to do is heal what we believe to be the worst schism in human history, and that is between the Jewish people and the Messiah of Israel. It's the biggie. It's the biggie because we start with the assumption that the God of Israel really does exist, that he is real, and that his covenant promises are true. And here you have Yeshua, the one man Israel, the one who captures in himself all that Israel's all about, the representation of God's very reality in this world, who as an ultimate picture of love and regard for the human race offers himself on that execution stake, thereby demonstrating, it's more than just a demonstration, there's more to it than that, but at very least a demonstration of God's character, his love, his kindness, his care. He's willing to take the hit himself for the sake of wayward people. And we go, wow, I'm talking about how to be young, live with wonder, let the wonder of that just seep into your soul and be there. And so why do we exist? What are we here for? What's the purpose? Why not do something else? We're here because there's that awful schism between Yeshua and his people, and what we want to do is help heal that schism. Church wasn't able to do that because its message to Israel is, sure, believe in your Messiah, but you got to be like us, forget Torah. And the Jewish people haven't helped in this regard because they have either ignored or, in some cases, actively opposed Yeshua, more often ignored him. But their message is, hey, he's not the Messiah, but we know he is. And so when you put those things together, and what we're here is to heal that schism. And it is an amazing, amazing thing to be part, a tiny part. I don't want to overstate our importance. God could wipe us out tomorrow, and listen, his plan will go on. But I want you to get a sense of it, why it's all important, and what we stand for, and why we do what we do, why we knock ourselves out to do the things we do. A corollary to this is a wonderful idea that I want to share with you very briefly, and we call it bilateral ecclesiology. We're grateful to Mark Kinzer, Dr. Mark Kinzer, for the wording, but the concept is something Ruach has always stood for, and that is, there is a holiness and beauty to the body of Messiah as the predominantly non-Jewish church. It is beautiful and good, even despite the anti-Semitism, even despite the wars, even despite all that, there is more goodness than there is bad, far more, and that the church has been God's tool of maintaining the tradition of Yeshua by her martyrs and by her scholars and by all the faithful little people who went to services on Sunday mornings. And you have that beautiful side of the community, and then you have the Jewish side of the equation, which we represent, and other Jewish believers, and the idea is that both of them, both of these two lungs, if you will. It's like two lungs. Both together represent God's covenant community in this world. It's an amazing thing. And that's why at Ruach, we've had great relationships with churches throughout the years. We have, in fact, when we built our building, we built it as a place where the nations could worship. We have our time, but they have their time as well, as we know. And so we have a terrific relationship with congregations. As I said, we built a building with the Mennonites, etc. Then think about our relationship with the Jewish community. That has improved dramatically over the years. Messianic Jews were pariah when I got started, roughly 40 years ago. We were just viewed as just a little strange expression of the Jesus movement that had no real meaning, no real value. It's just a bunch of silly people whose theology was confused and who actually were anti-Semitic at some level. I think a lot of Jewish people felt that way. That is changing. But I want to tell you, not too long ago, a major Jewish scholar, Daniel Boyarin, spoke at Ruach. Were you here for that talk? Some of you were, right? Apart from what he talked about, which was great, the mere fact that this Orthodox Jewish scholar, one of the top in the world, said, listen, I'm coming to you. You're Jews, and you're okay by me. I don't agree with you, but you are a Jewish community. Do you realize how seismic that is? It's absolutely seismic. Then, thanks to President Emeritus Diane Cohen, she orchestrated the Moshav band coming. Do you recall that one? That was great. Here you had this Orthodox Jewish group who were willing to even displease many in their audience and, you know, the Orthodox world. And this is a great part of the story, and Diane can tell it to you better than I can, but I remember the leader of the group went to his rabbi. We're talking about ultra-Orthodox type people. And he goes to his rabbi and says, listen, we've been invited, we've committed ourselves, but we can break it, you know, to go to this congregation. And he and his rabbi spent a half hour looking at the Ruach Israel website. And at the end, you know what his rabbi said? Go! Go do! You have an obligation to do your music there? Go do your music there. I think it's seismic. It's fabulous. Unheard of. Until now, things are changing. And so the Moshav band came, and again, a poetic element. What will we be raising money for at our concert? The very Torah scroll that Gary lifted 15 minutes ago. That was the scroll that we bought because of the proceeds from this Orthodox group coming. What we're seeing is these changes. We could talk about Camp Or Lador on the Jewish camps and all these various excited things. I promise there's a lot more I want to share with you. Let me conclude by saying this. We know that we live in a time when membership and active, faithful participation in a community is harder now than it ever has been in American history. Lots of reasons for it, sociological and otherwise. The pervasive disbelief. I mean, there's lots of things. I want to challenge you to live for something higher than yourself. Live for something that has a meaning that's so phenomenal, more than any political orientation, more than any social or economic movement. We're talking about something that is rooted in the very fabric of what the God of the universe had said. And we're just one little teeny place, believe me. And if we do bad, God will wipe us out and he'll start with somebody else. So again, I'm not trying to overly state the case, but I think what we have here is really, really special. And I want to encourage you to be at that meeting and to move ahead in your relationship with this community, that you will be joyful because you'll sense God's smile, but we together can really fulfill a destiny that's bigger than ourselves. We pick up next week. Shabbat Shalom.
Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah. Messiah.